Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 10th of February 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. It's just a just-in-time delivery today. We're delighted to say we've also got David Scott from Northern Exposure joining us, and he'll be commenting straight off with this one. Fake news, is it, Mike?
Fake news, David. What's going on?
Well, it's The Guardian, and people are starting to notice what's coming out of The Guardian, and it's not news. This is one in a long line of let's blame the Russians for everything articles that they've produced. In this case, we're blaming the Russians for the choices the American public made in selecting the 45th president of the United States. And on it goes with the usual whining and no argument, no reason, no information. But it's all the Russians, and it just comes across as really quite unhinged from reality. It doesn't have anything to say about the real world.
Well, this is probably, the Russians are probably responsible for the fact that The Guardian has had to lay off another 100 journalists recently. And perhaps what you're saying there, David, is the result of that, because once you lay off your most expensive and experienced journalists, who have you left?
Yes, I mean, back in the 30s, Malcolm Muggeridge, I think it was, who was the Guardian correspondent in Moscow, was one of the few Western journalists who told the truth about a genuinely despicable regime who was murdering people on a large scale and indulging in show trial after show trial. Now we have the Guardian blaming the Russians when it is, in fact, our own government that's launching such things as attacks on Libya, Syria, fill in name of nation, to suit yourself.
Yes.
Well, we've got really, we're going to have a bit more on the media when we talk about defence, an interesting little story that cropped up today. But before we go there, let's see what the future is for our media at a local level. I went to look at the Plymouth Herald website to see what our local paper had to say about the Royal Navy's famous Lynx helicopters being stepped down. And what came up was a block of text which said that I had to answer the questions, otherwise I couldn't see the article. So I scrolled down through this. I didn't like it. I felt bullied and intimidated. And I followed through the link to the partners, it says, of the Plymouth Herald here, which is Trinity Mirror. And then Trinity Mirror has got a lot of words saying why it's doing what it's doing. But it included this particular one, which can I skip a survey? Well, not at the moment, but we're looking at enabling that in the future. So what we can see here is censorship of the news. If you don't want to give away your thoughts, feelings, preferences, then you're not going to be allowed to see the news. And it's quite interesting that we can follow this through to Google. And I'll just remind people about the furore over the fact that Google, I can't remember what the turnover of Google is, but it's quite a lot of money. And Cameron let them get off with £130 million in tax. And of course, there's no, no connection here to this lady, Rachel, who was godfather to Cameron's late son. So it just appears that taxes for little people.
Rachel worked for Google, did she?
Rachel was, she was, what's the word they use, president of Google's European communications operation. So here's Rachel Whetstone, that was the name that was eluding me there. So she was fully tied in with David Cameron. Then David Cameron makes a decision about how much tax. This is separated in time, but I think we get the rough idea of what might be going on. And I'd encourage people to come back on this article, which is basically an excellent article by Martin Edwards on UK Column, where he's talking about the British media and bending the truth. And if you get into that, what he starts to point out is the connection between our favourite political charity, Common Purpose, and indeed the very same Trinity Mirror Group. So there's a lot of really good information in that article, and encourage people to get on the website and have a look at it.
OK, Ben Gummer. Ben Gummer is the Cabinet Office Minister. He is a Cabinet Office Minister. And he's been writing in the Times. And you may suggest that his first statement, the first sentence of his article in the Times is a piece of fake news, because he says that to govern is to serve. That is what he believes. So I'm going to say that's not entirely true. I don't believe he believes that. He says to govern is to serve. And he went on to say that if governing is to serve the people, it is consistent delivery of effective and efficient public services for the citizen that underpins everything we do as a government. In too many of their interactions with government, the public is made to feel as though they are the servants of the government rather than the other way around. And so he goes on. Now, what he was talking about here was the publication of the government's transformation strategy. So this is a big document, the government transformation strategy. It's about transforming relationships between the individual and the state. We'll come on to that in a second. But when you look down through this, what we're really talking about is the digitization of everything. So first, they are going to drive forward, they say, a renewed focus on digital government as the means to deliver services for the taxpayer. And so we're publishing the government transformation strategy outlining the government's commitment to utilize the virtues of technology to reshape government by ensuring millions of people are able to access online services they need whenever they need. So that should make us all feel good. As well as moving as many services online as possible, they say we must harness the value of open data as a means to innovate and improve the range of services available to the public and enhance the transparency of government. We will appoint a new chief data officer alongside the assembly of a data advisory board in order to best align our efforts to make the best use of data across government and to drive our open data and data transformation policies. We'll come on to that in a bit more detail in a second. Third, we, the government, will work to ensure that our civil service has an equality of representation around the United Kingdom so that public servants have a depth of experience of the public they serve. The Cabinet Office is currently reviewing the location of government agencies at arm length bodies and will consider relocating them where they could generate local area of expertise, support private sector growth and enable fair distribution of civil service expertise, especially at a senior level. Now, that we'll come on to the data bit in a second. This bit here, what he's actually saying is that a big part of this transformation strategy is the restructuring of government to reflect the devolution to the regions and the city states. This is the breaking apart of national institutions to be replaced with regional institutions. And it's, in a way, it's the fraud of Brexit, because, of course, this is the architecture of the European Union, Brian.
Yeah, but Brexit means we're coming out of the European Union, Mike. That's quite clear. Well, it's not. We'll be having a little look at Boris Johnson a bit later.
Right. And the fourth of the things that he mentioned was they're going to deliver all these changes and more while maintaining the government's constant drive to identify and drive efficiencies in government, root out fraud and error wherever possible, and make considerable savings for the hardworking taxpayer. And I just wanted, before we move on to the data section of this, I just wanted to remind everybody, what the situation is with regard to fraud and benefits overpayments. As an example, £1 billion of overpaid benefits recovered in 2015-16. This, I think we reported this in December. Overall fraud and error is lower last year than it was in 2010. Dedicated investigators working hard to pursue and prosecute those who try to defraud the system. And if you remember, we quoted David Freud, Minister for Welfare Reform, saying we've strengthened penalties and powers to combat fraud and error in the benefit system and are introducing reforms such as universal credit, which will reduce fraud and error and is expected to save £1 billion when fully rolled out. But the point that we made, of course, was that if we look at the statistics for fraud and error since 2005 to 2016, we find that around 2014 or so, there was a sudden switch between the percentage of what was considered fraud and what was considered error. So error, the percentage fell to 0.5%, and the percentage of fraud has risen to 1.1%. And the point that we made was that that happened not by accident, not by design, in the sense of, they have fixed their systems to such a degree that there's no possibility of error anymore. What they had done was they had redefined what fraud is. So by redefining that, they can increase their penalties and make sure that more people suffer as a result. But it's okay. We're redefining the relationship between the individual and the state, so there's no need to be concerned.
No need to be concerned. So we've got big data. We're going to make sure that tax is all claimed properly, unless you're Google, apparently.
Well, okay. Well, Google may be the beneficiaries of this, but let's move on. Let's go back to this, because big data is right at the heart of it. And they say that increasingly government departments will need to collaborate across traditional organizational boundaries. The vote to leave the European Union, because the Brexit vote has to be blamed on that. It's almost synonymous with Russia, but anyway, the vote to leave the European Union has heightened the need to be responsive and to be able to adapt to a changing environment. To build services that run seamlessly across government, we must take the next steps in transformation. We will strengthen our digital capability. We will improve trust between citizens and the state, giving citizens confidence that their personal data is secure and being used in the ways expected, while making government activity more transparent and making publicly owned non-personal data available for reuse where appropriate. So what they're going to do is they're going to make application programming interfaces, APIs, available to third parties like Google to get access to what they're describing as publicly owned non-personal data. So it's anonymized. And they talk about anonymization in the document. There is no such thing as anonymized data. And this has been covered right across the web in various articles, in academic papers. People have given demonstrations of how they can take so-called anonymized data, and when they attach that or they process that in parallel with other data, they can very quickly identify individuals. It's not easy to do, but when you're handing this data to the likes of Google, who do this kind of stuff day in, day out,
they can do it,
right? So there is no such thing as anonymized data. So this morning, Brian, I phoned the Information Commissioner's office to ask if they had been approached by the government for advice, perhaps, about how to deal with this data. They've been in discussions or put in any frameworks for this. They have not responded. So unfortunately, they don't seem to know anything about it or want to discuss it.
I think that's probably right. And while you were talking, what came into my mind was digital trials, because over the last couple of days, some of the newspapers have been crowing that we're very, very close now to people being able to be charged and then appear not in court and then be sentenced all digitally.
Right. So you have preempted me slightly, because that is exactly one of the case studies that is focused on within this document is digital courts. This digitization, this changing courts from being physical places to digital places has been driven by Sir Brian Leveson, who is very, very likely to be our next Lord Chief Justice when Lord John Thomas retires.
This looks like he's similar to the Leveson that ran the attempt to take state control of the media.
That is...
he's very similar, isn't it?
Genetically identical.
Yeah.
Whether he's a clone or not, I'm not certain, but he is genetically identical. But anyway, let's go back to Ben Gummer then, because what did he end up by saying? He said, as I hope I'm able to convey to you this morning, we will deliver our commitment to transform the relationship between the citizen and the state so the latter serves the former, not the other way around. Well, I'm sorry, but that is a pack of lies. He does not, even if he wanted to do that, which he doesn't, he does not have the ability to do that. And the simple reason is because of the Localism Act. So the Localism Act prevents him from changing that relationship because it's defined there. Clause 1 of the Localism Act says a local authority has the power to do anything that individuals generally do. It confers power in any way, whatever, including power to do it for commercial purpose or otherwise for a change, the power to do it for the benefit of the authority and not for the residents in the area. So you know, what we're talking about here is the fact that the relationship between the individual and the state has already changed. It's not reversible. Yes, it's not reversible without repealing legislation, and Gummer's not talking about that. So
at all. Perhaps we should bring in David. This stuff is pouring out. Many people are contacting us, emailing us, and saying speed. It's the speed at which this stuff is coming out of government. Now, I think this is all a sign that they are desperately worried about exposure. People are beginning to interpret government language. When the government speaks, they're always trying to reassure us. People are now seeing through and understanding what those words really mean. What's your take on digital government?
It's very interesting that Ben Gummer is asking the right question. He's got the wrong answer, but he is asking the right question, which is who serves who? Now, why would government even bring that up? The only possible explanation is that they are being asked day in, day out, in a thousand different ways, that very question. And people are rumbling the fact that they do not serve us, we serve them. And people are starting to ask questions that reveal that.
Just before you move on, David, I'll just mention this little quote here from this, because what he said is, I want to see a revolution in the way we deliver public services so that people up and down the country feel that government is at their service. So it's not about government being literally at their service. We've only got to feel that they're at our service.
So yeah, feelings is everything.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's beautifully put. Yes, feelings. Yes, we've got to be sufficiently fooled, and then we'll be happy slaves, Mike. It's just ridiculous. The idea that they are going to transform themselves to serve us when they have all the power and they are doing all the transforming is ridiculous to anybody who's ever met a human being. That is not how human beings work. They will tend to work in their own self-interest, not in other people's, by and large. And the government and people employed by government are no different. Imagine if you would that you had maybe Tesco or Asda or a large supermarket also had a monopoly of violence in the country and was able to force you at the pointy end of a bayonet to spend 30% of your salary on food and groceries in their shop every month. Under those circumstances, they would obviously remove all other competition. They'd become a monopoly supplier. And the quality of the goods and services would go steadily down. You would get less and less for your money. You would be treated less and less well, because there is no incentive for them to treat you well, just to make sure that the mechanisms of your enslavement are in satisfactory working order. And that's the nature of what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with an organization that respects individual liberty. We're dealing with an organization that wants to subvert individual liberty, but doesn't want to be caught doing it.
Right. Well, hold that thought, because as we move on to the next article here, because this is ITV News this morning reporting that eight in ten councils, local councils, are struggling to fund services properly. And what it's saying is, after 6 years of cuts to funding, 80% of councils say they have little or no confidence in their financial sustainability. Figures from the Local Government Information Unit reveal the new research shown to ITV News at 10 also found an overwhelming majority of councils, more than 9 in 10, felt they could increase council tax and start charging for service. They should increase council tax, rather, and start charging for services. Well, this is very interesting, because as we have on the UK Column website from John Hurst, an article here, Section 151 officer, council tax and fraudulent accounting. And what he's pointing out is the money squirreled away in little pots that people aren't really told about.
Vast amounts of money.
Now, he was giving the example of Powys Council, because that's where he lived. And he quoted from page 22 of the statement of accounts, showing that they had usable reserves of £55.9 million and unusable reserves of £246.3 million. This is money put in long-term savings accounts or speculated on Icelandic banks and so on. Now, when they were speculating with Icelandic banks and they were putting unusable reserves in Icelandic banks, they obviously lost a lot of money at that point. And following that, I did a Freedom of Information request with just about every council in the country, and found that what John Hurst had discovered about his own council in fact, is replicated right around the country, with some pretty huge amounts identified as being unusable reserves. That money hasn't disappeared. But David, as you say, we're getting less and less, but it's costing us more and more. And what's staggering is that as we continue through this swathe of austerity, and the NHS continues to crumble, and we have no defences, and education is a pile of poo. You know, we are spending and borrowing more year on year and getting less for it.
And this is rather inevitable. I mean, the people who analyse this from either an Austrian economics perspective or something called public choice economics, which was developed by Tulloch and Buchanan, economists, and they look at the decisions that governments make, local governments, central governments, and analyse it using the same sort of incentives that are used in conventional economics, and find that these things work just as well in that particular field. What you've got when you don't have competition keeping people honest, when you don't have that drive towards ever greater efficiency, the normal human nature takes over, where people want to provide the least possible work for the greatest possible reward. If you take that and you morph it into a large organisation, and you give that organisation monopoly powers and a monopoly of violence, you tend to end up paying more and more to that organisation and getting less and less. We're paying more and more for the health service, but we're getting less and less actual health care. When my children were small, if they were ill, you could phone the local doctor at 3 a.m. He'd be there in 5 minutes. It was an excellent service. It was run with less resources by far now. They were less well paid. They were less well everything. And it worked. Now, if you're ill, where do you go? You must drive to a golf course right away, because that's where you're going to find most doctors.
Yeah, well, and in fact, government transformation says that in the not-too-distant future, you won't be speaking to a GP. You'll be using Skype.
Yes, you'll be speaking to Skype, and then there's a whole series of telephone answering services and set questions, and the quality of service, the quality of the people you're talking to has gone down, you know, by an enormous leap. We're paying more, we're getting much less, and you see it everywhere. I had to go with my granddaughter to a hospital in the middle of the night not that long ago, and for the whole of Tayside, there was one very, very small hospital in Dundee, and that was the only one that was open. There was no out-of-hours surgeries. The people had to go there, and there was one woman on the reception desk, and I remember saying to her, whatever you do, you go to the loo, don't slip in the floor, because you are the NHS. If you go down tonight, there is nothing. And that was sort of a huge slice of Scotland.
Mm. Well, let's take the story on, because the great lie of no money, money created from nothing, but no, there's no money. Let's go back to defence. And we've got this extraordinary story from The Telegraph. And the headline is, Britain's entire fleet of attack submarines are out of action. Now, just to put this in context, attack submarines are nuclear submarines that are out there looking for other submarines and surface ships. But a big part of their job is to look after our nuclear deterrent submarines. So the nuclear deterrent submarines apparently still at sea, but there's no attack submarines to defend them. So the headline from The Telegraph, very specific, the entire fleet of attack submarines is out of action. The Royal Navy says this, we don't comment on specific submarine operations. Britain has a world-class fleet. The Royal Navy continues to meet all of its operational tasking, deploying globally on operations and protecting our national interests as Britain steps up around the world. So the Royal Navy has said, basically, this story is not true, in my opinion. Let's just have a look at it. Where did The Telegraph get this information from? Well, we phoned the Telegraph news desk this morning. We spoke to an extremely aggressive and unpleasant man. We said, where's the evidence for this story? And he said, The Sun. It came from The Sun, Mike.
So that is an admission from The Telegraph news desk that they're poaching stories from other newspapers?
That's what he said. I asked him, where did this story come from? Where's the evidence? And he said, The Sun. And right. I said,
The Sun said that the Sun said that the big threat that we're no longer policing because the subs are not at sea is the threat to international commerce and sea lanes posed by Iran. Iran. I'm speechless.
Yeah, because we're
that
back
huge
on
maritime power.
We're yes. back on the fact that we're seeing this utterly bizarre language coming out from our politicians and the press. This is something out of Alice in Wonderland. So we're told it was the Sun. I pressed the Telegraph man on evidence. Was there evidence? And he muttered, "Well, the Sun article says." And I said, "Well, that's hearsay." Whereupon the telephone was not put down; it was smashed down. You could hear the strain of the plastic the other end. This man was venomous when I challenged him as to the veracity of that Telegraph article. Well done, David, because can I bring this one? Yeah. This one here. You've got this one. Here's the Sun. Subs zero. The Royal Navy's entire fleet of attack submarines is out of action, and Theresa May doesn't know because chiefs fear a reaction. Now, what is this? Is this some form of kindergarten being run here? We've seen the First Sea Lord was over boasting to the Americans about our capability last October. But I'm going to bring this point in again because it is so important. If this article is true, then Britain's nuclear deterrent is utterly exposed at sea. There's no Nimrod aircraft. There's no attack submarines. This means Britain's nuclear deterrent is effectively nearly a sitting duck. And who's actually talking about this? Well, the papers are not talking about it. So is this fake news or is the government lying? You had a slide of a lady saying that when people don't know what's true and what's not, they go into no man's land because you have no idea what's actually going on. So an incredible story, and we haven't got to the bottom of it. But if you dare to ask the Daily Telegraph, where's your research on this story? Oh, we just got it from the Sun. So if you're somebody who pays for your Daily Telegraph, you might as well stop paying for it because you can simply pick up a Sun and there's all your news. I don't know how else to do on that. So let's have a look at this serious issue. So we'll bring on, it's one of Britain's nuclear submarines that was damaged. This was off Gibraltar. So if you have a close look at the picture, the fin, it isn't the conning tower, it's called the fin, has got a little bit of collision damage. So that was another submarine that had a problem. But what are local MPs talking about? Well, here we are. This is Oliver Colville. Plymouth MP should be absolutely focused on the Royal Navy and defence and what's happening. And what is he tweeting out? That he's done a really good job on a seagull and hedgehog debate. So drifting into madness, Mike, drifting into madness throughout the Conservative government. And we've now got newspaper articles, completely untrustworthy, 1984. Well, we need a solution, so we better put up our advert. Nottingham, we've got the British Constitution Group meeting on the 22nd of April. And you'd said to us, we never get a real chance to talk at events and get to know one another and share ideas because we always get to the end of the day and then we've got to leave the hall. That's what people constantly say to us. So we say we have created a space for nearly 1,000 people to meet, talk, get to know each other and share ideas and team up. So we hope that you will be signing up and getting your advance ticket, which is a mere £10 to come to that event and really meet other people. And David, you've got an advert here for your meet in Scotland, if you'd like to tell us a little bit more.
Yes, this was last Sunday's meet in Dunblane. Which was excellent. You see, Robert Green there made it up from the south, and he gave a very impassioned speech, which you can catch on YouTube via the Holly Gregg Justice website. The chap sitting next to him with the iron brew and the bobble hat is Robert Sproul. Now he's taking the fight very much to the Scottish justice system, and having huge success in doing this. And this was prompted by an attack on his family, which saw a close relative's child taken by the state in a completely unlawful fashion. And Robert's fighting back. Fantastic speaker. He really laid it on the line. And it's someone that we'll be seeking to follow as he takes the fight to the authorities, because he'll be speaking and acting quite robustly, I think, in the weeks and months to come. And that's myself there standing up, and Neil McKechnie on the end. Neil took us through his own personal story, which is an extremely troubling one, and one which in the UK column we want to come back to and look soon in more detail, because he has been up against the entire Scottish legal establishment, which has revealed fraud to the very top. And many, many strange things that made no sense at the time, but which he subsequently managed to diagnose by following the relationships and the fraudulent relationships all the way through the legal system and all of the checks and balances that are meant to support and protect the public. It shows the system is entirely broken.
Okay, thank you for that. And I'll just interject here and say that we've had a few people saying, can we push out more details of where your when and where your meetings will be held? So we'll deal with that off air. But just recognising that people are showing great interest in being able to get along to your meetings north of the border.
We're planning to have one in around a month in Aberdeen. To look at the Doherty case, the Sean Ritchie case, and the Holly Gregg case. So details on that will follow.
Okay.
Okay. Unaccompanied children, back in the news again. The government announced yesterday only 350 children would be coming to the UK under the scheme that's called the Dubs scheme. Much fewer than the 3,000 that David Cameron had originally asked for. What did Amber Rudd have to say? She said scrapping the Dubs Amendment was partly because it encourages people traffickers. So I thought that was an interesting statement. And so they're not going to bring very many children to the UK. And I have to say that this was all completely unnecessary. Back in November, we had this report, Heading Back to Harm, from the NGO ECPAT UK, and the charity Missing People, and they were saying that 30% of all UK child trafficking victims and 13% of unaccompanied children were disappearing from the UK's care systems. And this was the issue that we raised over a year ago now, the fact that so many people are missing from the UK's care system. This report said that 167 of 590 children suspected or identified as child trafficking victims in the year from September 2014 to 2015 had vanished from foster care and from care homes across the country, and that 593 of the 4,744 unaccompanied children placed under protection of local authorities also went missing at least once in the same time period. Now, there's only one person, I'm going to say, there's only one person to blame for this, and that is Tim Farron, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, because, of course, he's the man that began the campaign to bring the latest swathe of unaccompanied children to the UK. He's the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, and he was told by us and others over a year ago that children should not be brought to this country until the issue of trafficking from care was dealt with. And we pointed out, we reminded him of the all-party parliamentary group for runaway and missing children and adults, that their looked after children and care leavers report, the fact that this was chaired by Anne Coffey MP, the fact that they were absolutely saying that this was a national scandal involving children missing from care, and until recent cases of child sexual exploitation in Rochdale and other places put the spotlight on the issue, it was going on pretty much unnoticed. So that report published in 2012. MPs, plenty of time to read it, plenty of time to understand it, plenty of time to do something about it. Tim Farron, in the meantime, absolutely pushing for unaccompanied children to come into this country. When this report is thrown at him and said, what are you going to do about this? He says he's going to do nothing about it. He was completely, how do you describe it? He was, his response...
Dismissive, completely dismissive.
Absolutely. So now what I've got on screen as a quote there, but if I do something about my parliamentary colleagues of all parties, they would have nothing to play with. That, he didn't say that, of course, but his attitude was tantamount to that.
Well, he was the one who said, yes, he accepts that many of these children would have been trafficked and abused. He actually said that in his email. And how many are we talking about? Well, over 300 Syrian children simply disappear. The Metropolitan Police, we've also been on to them saying, what have you done to find these children? They've now got to the stage where they simply won't respond to telephone calls or emails.
Right, and this is reflected on a much broader basis as well, because as we mentioned a week or so ago, Interpol recently issued a press release saying that they had identified 10,000 child victims of sexual exploitation. And when I wrote to them and said, okay, you've identified the victims, how many people have been prosecuted as a result of that identification? And they said, we don't keep those statistics. So here we've got an international policing organization that publishes a press release about children exploited, and they aren't doing their jobs.
Because nobody's interested in the missing children. I'll just also bring in the Archbishop of Canterbury, Mr. Welby, because he's very upset we're not having more children coming into Britain. But this is the same Archbishop of Canterbury that doesn't want to talk about child abuse. He doesn't want to talk about child abuse in the church. And, of course, we've recently had yet another article of abuse in the church, which his church covered up by not telling the police the abuse had happened. So there seems to be an unnatural desire to get children into the UK, knowing that these children are going to disappear, be abused, trafficked, or, as our Met whistleblower said, end up dead in the gutter. David, this is pretty horrific stuff, really.
I was looking at a press conference from California that was transmitted on YouTube, and I put out as a tweet just a few days ago. And this was reporting 450-odd arrests in a major crackdown on child trafficking for child sexual abuse. And 70% of the victims, or over 70% of the victims, were from the care system. So it's the world over, the Western world certainly, all over, that the care system simply acts as an enormous child brothel and channels these kids into the most horrendous situations and gives them, in many, many regards, no hope.
Okay, let's move on. David, another NHS scandal inevitable?
Yes, this is point we're making earlier on, that we're getting more and more money is going in and we're getting less and less result for it. And this is visible in all public services. And it's the realisation for that that's driving so much that the state's trying to do, the new model Scottish government, the joined up thinking, the attempts at some sort of pseudo-privatisation. But here you see, again, huge resources went into the NHS, but the storm clouds are gathering once again as the system is breaking down. And it was interesting that the person who ran the Staffordshire inquiry is leading the call here to say that the same problems are going to arise again. And we might wonder, in fact, if they ever went away.
Okay, and let's let everybody know that we did publish the letter that you discussed last Friday from the Dohertys.
Yes, and I had another letter come in from Brian Doherty late last night on email, or rather half of one time he said was pressing. But this is a full and detailed line-by-line dialogue account of his exchange with the Garda, and it's going to continue, I suspect, to his exchange with the psychiatrist who was trying to section him. The Garda kept repeating that they had a common law power to stop anybody, anywhere, anytime in Ireland. This was a surprise to Brian. It's a surprise to me because obviously under the common law, we're all equal. So if they have that power, then so do we. And they couldn't give Brian any explanation as to why they had a legitimate reason to stop him, but they stopped him anyway and subsequently pulled him from the car and took him to see the psychiatrist, who had to admit that there was no reason to hold him and let him go once again.
They never seem to learn, David.
No. And one of the good things we'll get from the information that's coming now from Brian Doherty is we'll get lots of names. So we'll get specifics, and that will allow people to contact the specific people involved and ask them for an explanation of their actions.
Good. Okay. Well, now, quite some time ago, would it have been a year since we discussed this this wall falling down? Because this, again, is crumbling infrastructure.
Yes, I just thought it was worth tying this up. The official report on this failure came out. Now, this wall you see here came down early one morning. It's the school's called Oxgangs Primary School. It's near Edinburgh. And it came down in winds of around 60 to 70 miles an hour. So strong winds, but not out of the normal way for central Scotland. And the problem was that the wall ties that secured the outer leaf, which collapsed to the inner leaf, which is in turn secured to the steel frame, were not embedded in the outer leaf hardly at all. And so you had an almost freestanding pile of bricks, and the wind just sucked it off the building and it collapsed down. And it could have been horrendous if it had been a couple of hours later and the children had been in the school or in the playground. It could have been horrendous, but fortunately no one was hurt. The explanation went into it. They found that it wasn't anything to do with PFI per se, the way the buildings were procured, but to a lack of skill, talent, ability and supervision on the job. So you see here craft skills being eroded, you see abilities being eroded, and the reliability of what we produce as a nation going down. It's a sign of a quite deep-seated malaise, I think. There are no simple answers to this, but answers should be sought. And problems like this can, of course, be tackled. It's just a case of having the will and the clarity of judgment, the clarity of insight into what's actually going wrong to make a difference. No amount of bureaucratic paper shuffling to extract more wealth from people will actually address this this problem. We need to have people who are able to look at the real problems and find real practical solutions that work on site in reality in the world.
Indeed. And another case that we have mentioned in the past, we haven't discussed for some time, is the death of Sheku Beo in custody in Scotland. And this from the Courier, saying that Nicola Sturgeon was pressed over the situation at First Minister's Questions. And we have another one here saying that the Beo family is to meet the Lord Advocate this week. So bring us up to date then.
Yes, up to date. This is Scotland. This is an inquiry into a suspicious death. And the perpetrators were members of the state establishment. Therefore, there is no bringing up to date. We've had a year has passed and there's been no progress. Nicola Sturgeon was pressed at First Minister's Question by an MSP who was at the Sheku Beo march, and she's obviously still on the case and still pressing. And the family are, and the lawyer is, but it's going through the Crown Office. And remember, Jock Thompson QC stated that the Crown Office was institutionally corrupt, and it's going through the Lord Advocate. And one of the issues in Scotland is everything goes through the Lord Advocate. There's no private prosecutions. There are no other routes to justice that do not go through the Lord Advocate. So if the Lord Advocate says no, and the Lord Advocate's office in all these regards is exempt from freedom of information laws, and everything is done in private, in secret, and there's no public accountability. If the Lord Advocate says no, then it's no, and there is no justice in Scotland. So that's the degree of power the Lord Advocate has and is using and is not using in the interest of the people, I would suggest.
And of course, that was the problem with the Holly Gregg case, because the Lord Advocate said no.
The Lord Advocate said no, and the Lord Advocate was obviously heavily involved all the way through the line on the Holly Gregg case, because the Lord Advocate was Dame Elise Angelini, who had been Procurator Fiscal in Aberdeen when the most serious allegations actually came to light.
Okay, and then just briefly, David, bring us up to date with John Mason. He's now apologised for his comments, which I suppose you were partly responsible for generating. And even Nippy has had to apologise.
The sound of apology is loud in the land. John Mason, after 9 days, suddenly apologised in quite a fulsome way. And the Three Soldiers campaign accepted that and said that they want to move on. They want to concentrate on the campaign, not on this issue. Only for letters, emails to then be leaked to the campaign by some good-hearted soul, and whoever you are, thank you, in the press office of the SNP. And these letters showed that the chief whip and senior spin doctor of the SNP had John Mason in for a chat and had instructed him to issue this apology, and the reasons were stated, and the reasons were all to do with the political embarrassment it was causing, the fact that Nicola Sturgeon was being questioned in public about this, and the fact that many MSPs were having lots of correspondence from their constituents. It does show it does make a difference, regarding this matter. So the apology was politically motivated, an issue that has been a huge disappointment to the family. Now, I was lucky enough to meet Nicola Sturgeon on Monday because the Scottish Government were doing a cabinet meeting in Putlochry and a Meet the People session thereafter. And one of the best things about the Scottish Government, actually, and I don't often say good things about them, is they do actually do this, and they will have a cup of tea with the people, and you can go up to them and have an exchange. So I raised this issue with Nicola Sturgeon, and she undertook to enter into discussions with the campaign to see if she could do something positive to help. Now, the campaign have now publicly called on her to meet with them, so we'll keep an eye on that, and we'll see if she's able to help find some justice for the families of these three soldiers.
Okay, well, very, very quickly, let's just squeeze in a bit of fun, but it's serious fun. A lady got very upset with the fact that I'm constantly warning, well, of course, UK Column's warning, that Brexit is a scam, and while Theresa May is talking Brexit, we're actually adopting all of the laws, customs, we're being locked in, and the military's being locked in. So Angie said, same relationship, except we're out. Stop lying and stirring trouble over Brexit.
Stop lying, Brian.
Yep, apparently we're lying. Well, we're going to stick by our guns of what we're saying. I followed this lady through, and here she is, and I find that she campaigned twice for Boris Johnson, now blog and tweet in his support, all comments, opinions her own, and then there's a reference to Cyber Boris. So I thought that was pretty interesting. You can see she's put out 408,000 tweets. 408,000. That's quite interesting. We say each one took her a minute, but we can work on that. Well, this is Cyber Boris, and very strange information. He gave a very weird talk at Athenaeum Civilization. I'll leave somebody to have a look into that. But Conservatives being deceived by their own government is what's going on here. And that led me to Boris's Twitter page, and this made me feel sick. This is his banner. Basically, I've put this caption in. You're laughing now, but behind the scenes, us Tories are dismantling UK's infrastructure, military and society. And sorry, that should be, and stealing your grandchildren, all things you fought to stop. The cynicism here is quite unbelievable. And what else did Boris have to say? Well, Italy, a strong partner for UK. Together, we're helping Libya and boosting energy security. And of course, what that really means is that we've done Libya and helped ourselves to their oil. And of course, let's have a look at Libya with Gaddafi. A lot of actual beautiful areas and parts to the city. And as the bottom image shows, Libya after American and British democracy. So vile stuff, but we've got people who believe what these Tory politicians say. We don't.
No.
David, thank you very much for joining us. 10 seconds to close.
I would simply say that what we're going to do over the next weeks and months is we're going to never miss an opportunity to tell the truth. That's a subject of an article that's about to come out in the column, and I would encourage people to do just that, and it's very liberating.
Excellent. Okay, thanks very much for that. Well, that brings us to the end of today's news. We're almost halfway through February. Where does the time go? Thank you for joining us. Thank you to those that have been subscribing. If you're not a subscriber, please become one, because we can only do what we do with your help and support. We'll be back same time on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.